You're listening to Doing Law Differently. Join me, Lucy Dickens, as I explore how the world's most progressive legal service providers are doing law differently. Hello, welcome back to the Doing Law Differently podcast. I'm your host, Lucy Dickens, and today I am joined by Mitch Kowalski, who I am really excited to be interviewing on the podcast. I'm a really big fan of his work and his books, and I've seen him speak, and I was really quite excited to have the opportunity to talk to him some more and to have a conversation really about some of the ideas and thoughts that he has about the legal profession. If you haven't come across Mitch before, he describes himself as an innovation consultant, but I think he's so much more than that. He really is one of the true thought leaders in our profession. He's an author and a legal operations advisor with global credibility and international experience. He's a fellow of the College of Law Practice Management, author of two critically acclaimed books on legal operations transformation. The first, The Great Legal Reformation, Notes from the Field. And the second, Avoiding Extinction, Reimagining Legal Services for the 21st Century. And both are really great books, and I highly recommend them to you if you haven't read them already. Mitch and I cover a lot of ground around reforming the profession, from what changes we will or we should see from COVID, his thoughts around the business model for the law firm of the future, and what he thinks we need to do to shake up universities, among lots of other little bits and pieces thrown in along the way. Now, I don't want to keep you any longer, so let's just hit play. Here is Mitch Kowalski on the Doing Law Differently podcast. Mitch, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. As I mentioned to you just before, I saw you speak when you came to Perth a couple of years ago. And since then, I've gone off and read both of your books because I loved what you had to say. So I'm really excited to now get the chance to talk to you. A lot of what you've written about really, really resonates with me.
Well, that's the thing that really makes me happy, is that there's some message somewhere out of one page or two pages or one paragraph that resonate with someone and sets them off on a journey. So that means a lot to me. Thank you.
It definitely did. I mean, starting with your first book, Avoiding Extinction, I've got it here because I brought them with me to the interview. I saw so many parallels between your fictional firm and the firm that I work for. And so reading you say, this is what an ideal law firm should look like in the future. And I'm like, yeah, we do that too. And I just found that really, really encouraging.
Excellent. Well, I mean, you know, that book was written in 2012, so it's 8 years ago. And that was just me sort of trying to pull together all the little pieces of things that were happening at that time and in the few years before, and saying, okay, if we had to blow this whole thing up and build it from scratch, and we didn't know what a law firm was supposed to look like, we're Martians from Mars, how exactly would we do this? And, you know, it wasn't we would set up a partnership and start doing all these sort of things. It was like, okay, let's really be serious and think about it. So I'm glad your firm was doing that. They drank the Kool-Aid, as it was. You know, what's interesting to me, though, is there was an article just the other day up in North America about some of the big four who are now talking about going to a hub and spoke kind of office model. And they said, wow, that's really where we're going to be going now. And I went, dude, I wrote about that, you know, almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you finally think it's a good idea. So it's funny with that book, how it sort of comes and goes and people pick up things and do things years later.
Yeah. But I mean, even though it was written a few years ago, it's still quite current. And I guess actually that's a question that I'm interested in your views on, around the pace of change in the profession, because you've written two books. The second book was 2017, I think.
17 or 18. I can't, 18, everything's
yeah, okay.
Blurry now, but yeah.
Yeah, it was a few years ago. So what do you say about the pace of change since you published your books?
Well, I'm going to be the contrarian, because a lot of people will say, wow, we've come a long way and things are, you know, are moving so fast. In a few more years, it's going to be so different. And so I'm going to tell you, it's excruciatingly slow for me. It's been glacial. It hasn't happened as fast as I'd like it to happen. I think there's still a long way to go. I think there's far too much inertia in the law profession. And so that really holds us back, along with the fact that, as we're finding out with this Thomson Reuters report that's just come out in Australia, that apparently Australian law firms have been doing better than any other law firm in the world over the last year or so. So why would I change, right? Maybe I'll just gonna, you know, play around the edges. And so I really think the pace of change, there has been moving along that path, but it's been brutally slow. I mean, COVID's a great example. The stuff that we're doing now, though, you know, how we're working from home in whatever form we're doing it, sitting in, you know, bad chairs and bad tables and stuff and wrecking our backs and stuff. But we could have done this 5 years ago. We could have done this 10 years ago. We didn't, because we didn't have to. So that is really the message for me, is that law firms don't change unless they have to. So when COVID eventually goes away, maybe 6 months from now, maybe a year from now, maybe 2 years from now, I still think that lawyers are going to fall back to, gosh, it's so good to be back at the office. I hated working from home because I wasn't set up properly. So in answer to your question, the pace of change has been slow. I think it's going to continue to be slow. There'll always be outliers who will say, this is a great advantage for me. If you lot don't want to follow me, that's okay. I'll just move forward and have a better practice and have happier clients and make more money. So it's such a weird profession that we're part of.
Good way to describe it. I tend to agree with you, and I think it's easy. I, at least, and others that I speak to, tend to surround ourselves with like-minded people. So most of the lawyers who I know and who are my colleagues and friends are doing value pricing, and they're working on process improvement, and they're employing people who don't have practicing certificates and all that kind of thing. And so I kind of tend to be in this little bubble where I think, yeah, this is all happening now. But then as soon as you step outside that, you realize that actually it's not. It's just the people who I'm surrounding myself with.
100%. I have to check myself all the time because I'm in that same bubble, right? The people I enjoy hanging out with, we're all in the same mind. We're all talking about this stuff. But then I'll be asked to do a retreat at some law firm. And I'll say stuff that to me is, well, I've been saying this forever, guys. You know, surely this can't be interesting. And people will still come to me and go, oh my God, that was like unbelievable. And I'm like, really? Like, where have you been for 10 years, right? So I'm a little bit pessimistic. I'm a little bit angry, perhaps is another word. But yeah, it really is, as you say, a bubble that we have to understand that, you know, us in our 10 friends or 20 friends or 50 friends in the industry is such a tiny drop in the bucket of every single lawyer in Australia or Canada or US or whatever, that it is a huge mountain to move. And really, just going back to your original question about pace of change, we have to look at the profession as a whole in terms of pace and change. And so I find when a lot of people talk about, wow, we're really moving forward, it's like, because you're focused on your bubble. And so if you put the bubble in with the bucket, you see that the bucket really hasn't moved. You know, a few little drops in the bucket, or maybe 20 drops in the bucket, have moved. You might have a little bit of a ripple, but it ain't really moving that much. So that's how I look at the pace of change. Has the profession as a whole moved forward? Great example over here in Canada with the whole COVID situation, there was massive gnashing of teeth of whether or not people could witness wills via Zoom calls. That was like outrageous issue to even consider that. And then it was like, well, gosh, finally the Law Society got involved, and the Law Society is the regular over here, and said, okay, just for this time during COVID, we'll allow you to do this. And then we're going to go back. One of the Law Society in British Columbia, which I'm also a member of, same thing. They're waiting with bated breath to say, okay, all this stuff that we did only for COVID, we're going to get rid of it and go back to this old way. So that is telling.
Yeah, it's a good example. It's similar here in Australia, and I can't remember which states have enacted the legislation, but some of them have. I think it might have been Victoria. A similar thing. It's a trend. It's going to stop as soon as COVID's gone. You're not allowed to do this anymore. But it's not every state. They haven't all got on board. So we kind of, you know, I mean, that's just the way things work here, isn't it? It's piece by piece. But COVID's an interesting topic because everyone's talking about how it's going to change the ways of work. And so there's remote working, there's things like witnessing wills. What do you think are some of the key impacts on the legal profession, or what will be?
Well, I think the greatest impact, or the greatest impact that it should have, really, there are a couple of them, but let's look at litigation, because there are still an awful lot of litigation lawyers who feel that there's some magic power to being in person, and that if you're not in person, you're not doing your job. You can't read the judge properly. You can't read witnesses properly, which is all utter crap. But that should be the great leap forward in terms of the COVID legacy for legal services, is to move as much things as possible off in-person appearances. So anything that doesn't involve a witness should be automatically, it's not in person, right? Setting dates, you know, adjournments, all this kind of stuff that lawyers in a lot of jurisdictions, I have to show up in person just to say, can we move this to another date? Doesn't make a lot of sense to most people. So if we can move all that stuff off, that would be a massive leap forward. That's a massive opportunity that the profession as a whole fights tooth and nail still to this day. It's that mentality that, you know, this is a time-limited thing that we'll muddle through, but I can't wait to get back and put on my gown and appear in front of a judge. And more importantly, wait in a courtroom for my next turn, which is a huge waste of money. So that is a massive, massive opportunity that I think we're going to miss. I'm part of a working group with one of the provinces here with the Attorney General, and we're begging them actually to do that and say, it should just be automatic. The default should be virtual hearings. And if it's in person, it should be on special circumstances. And it's still difficult for them to get that. Think of the money they would save in terms of just premises and stuff like that. It would be massive. But that's one opportunity. The other opportunity, I think, and again, lawyers are missing this, and I'll tell you the story around that, is the fact that there should be a ton of lawyers out there at large firms. So let's talk about the big end of town. There should be a ton of lawyers out there who, over this COVID, and I understand Australia didn't get hit as badly as Canada or US and UK and so on. Nonetheless, there should be a lot of lawyers who have been working at home for an extended period of time who should have had a light bulb going off and saying, hang on a second, how much money am I leaving on the table by staying at this big firm? Because I've been working at home and it's kind of okay. So I don't need my huge marble palace in the sky paying tons of money in rent. I don't need all the other bells and whistles that I have that I'm paying for. My clients are still pretty happy with me just working from my dining room table. So what the hell am I doing? Why wouldn't I go alone or with a small group of my friends and just create a remote working outfit? Because the proof is in the pudding. This is the pilot. COVID was the pilot. We've shown that we can do this, and we've shown that the clients are okay with it. So why would we stick with a big firm environment, you know, most of which we don't use? So
I think that's starting to happen. I'm having more and more conversations with people who are starting or thinking about or making the leap to start their own firm. And a lot of them are kind of thinking, is this crazy to do this during a global pandemic? But just like you say, this actually provides a lot of opportunities for people to do this. And now is a good time.
It's amazing. But I'll give you the flip side of that, because I'm general counsel for a company here in Canada. I'm helping them build out their legal department. So that's a lot of fun. But it also puts me in touch with the lawyers that are my service providers. And it's interesting to see that dynamic from that perspective. But one of the lawyers, I said to him straight out, I said, we like you. You do good work for us. You're doing work for us that you don't need a lot of people with you, and stuff that it's advisory work, it's some drafting work that we don't really care where you are. We don't even care what firm you're at, because we came for you. So I told him straight out, I said, why wouldn't you just leave? Like, we'll stick with you. I can tell you 100% we'll stick with you. We're not your biggest client, but have you not thought about that? And he said, yeah, I thought about that, but, and here's the rub. But the administration and all that kind of stuff just drives me crazy. And I don't have to worry about that at my big firm. And I said, you know, you can hire someone to do that, and it's still not going to come close to the overhead you're paying your big firm. So, you know, there's risk averse, and then there's lots of excuse making. So it still takes a pretty special person to make that leap from the safety of, you know, the nice, cozy big firm. But hopefully we'll see some interesting things happen.
There are businesses, aren't there, who are set up to do just that kind of thing, where they say, we're going to do that, we're going to take care of the overheads and the administration and the insurance and all that kind of thing, and you just do your legal work and pay us a percentage. I've spoken to on this podcast, and the names are just escaping me, which is terrible, but I'm sure you're familiar with these kinds of businesses.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them out there. Free Range out in Perth is a version of that.
Yeah, Free Range Lawyers, Catherine's doing. Plexus. Plexus coming to mind.
Is like that. There's more and more of them sprouting up that sort of take that effort off your hands and just let you do the legal work, which is really why everybody went to law school, is to do the fun part or the interesting part and leave the accounting and the administration stuff to someone else. And yeah, it's not overly expensive and lets you do what you want to do. But it would be nice to see, and this is just me blue skying, is to see whether the big law firms get beat up a little bit over this and they start losing people in groups to a better form of practice. And maybe that'll drive them to operate in a different fashion, because until that happens, they're not really going to change. They're going to continue to do what they do and play around the edges. And some of them, you know, have some interesting technology groups and stuff happening, but it's not permeated throughout the whole firm. We'll see.
And maybe it needs that to happen en masse, because there are lots, all sorts of examples of groups leaving big law to go and set, you know, small groups of two or three people to go and set up their own firm. But maybe until it starts to happen en masse that.
Yeah, well, like the worst thing that could happen is they leave and they set up exactly what they left with just, you know, slightly different overhead. Because, you know, certainly we've seen that over time. People break away from law firms already and then they just rent space. They organize themselves the same way. Their processes are the same. And it's just, you know, a mini version of what they left, except they have a little bit more control. So what you and I are talking about is, yeah, we're not even going to do that. We're just going to break apart and we're going to reimagine how we're going to do this and just make ourselves and our clients a lot happier.
I'm so excited to share that my new book, It's Time to Do Law Differently, will be published in October 2020. I am so excited to publish this book, which shares a really simple 6-step roadmap to help you reshape your law firm and reclaim your life. Be your first to get your hands on a copy by registering now at lucydickens.com.au/book, and you'll be the first to know when the book is available for sale. Let's talk about that reimagining part. Your second book, The Great Legal Reformation, is Notes from the Field. So this is basically your case studies where you went around the world and you spoke to different law firms and reported on how they were operating. I have a friend, Fiona McClay, who's a lawyer based in Melbourne, and she's quite well known here in the legal innovation space, especially legal tech, and she's a fan of yours. I told her that I was going to be speaking to you today, and she had this question for you, and I thought it was a really good question, and I wanted to give her credit for the question, which is why I've just told you about her. So Fiona's question for you is around, what do you see as having lasting success? Because she recognises that of the companies who you spoke to in that book, Great Legal Reformation, a lot of them no longer exist in the form that they existed in or that you spoke about them in the book. So her question is, what do you think is going to endure? What's going to be the lasting, I guess, what are the elements that are going to be the, what are the elements that are going to last?
Sure. Well, I think the dispersed setup, I mean, you know, Gunnar Cook is still around, Inksters is still around, Obelisk is still around, Conduit is still around. And so firms of that nature that are dispersed, that built out, you know, a technological platform that allows people to practice when and where they want to, I think is here to stay. And, you know, it's certainly growing far beyond those. Well, I think what's interesting to me is that there are more and more law firms going public these days, which I never would have thought. I thought Slater's was kind of a one-off, and then there's, you know, a couple of IP firms that did it. But now it seems to be growing in leaps and bounds. I mean, the HW Ebsworth, you know, may or may not happen in the next month or so. So I think that is something I think that's here to stay, just simply because more and more people are doing it and the market seems to be accepting of that. Shine is doing well. Slater's has apparently come back to life very well, had a really great year. And I think the firms who are thinking of going public are thinking about more is their processes and how the whole is greater than the pieces. And so looking at the law firm as an actual entity that delivers services en masse instead of a group of individuals who all do work individually. And so
and just happen to do it from the same place.
Exactly. More a cooperative kind of thing. Yeah, we all sort of kick in and we share the overhead, and maybe I use you from time to time and I have a clerk or an admin that I use from time to time, but really it's all about me. And so the takeaway that I think is that will hopefully grow is that sort of firm first feeling that the firm delivers the service, and whoever it is within the firm doesn't really matter. It's the firm, because it's the process, the technology, and how everything interacts with the people that provide the product. So in that sense, there's no key partner risk. So if so-and-so leaves, the firm's, you know, you're never happy to lose people. But on the other hand, if you lose somebody at any other company, the company doesn't fold and freak out and lose all this business, right? Because people come to it because of the way the services are delivered, and they're delivered in a way that can't be easily duplicated. And so in that sense, that's the thing that I think will continue to happen, and that will be a legacy item. We talked about the dispersed firms, and I guess the other thing about the dispersed firms is giving lawyers more freedom to work where and when they want. And I think that is maybe slightly obvious, but that's another legacy item. The process-driven firms, you would have thought that, you know, understanding, you know, doing the right thing at the right time with the right people in the right order would be something that people would wrap their heads around and really enjoy doing and see the results from. But apparently not. Yeah, apparently not. So that is the process, Lean Six Sigma kind of stuff, I think will continue to move at a glacial pace. But it does actually fit together with that full firm dynamic that you see at a Slater's or a Shine or something like that. It's a necessary component of it. So in that sense, it'll eventually come around, at least with those firms. But as a whole, I don't know what it is about lawyers. Everybody likes to do their own thing and doesn't like to be too troubled by following a firm set of rules around things.
I know. And that always confuses me, because the first thing we do when we need to draft a document or we're running a trial or whatever it might be is go look for a precedent. And to me, process is that on steroids, I guess, because, you know, if somebody's already done this before, I talk about it as being like a recipe or a method. If you're making a cake, you wouldn't start from scratch. You would go find the recipe and you would do what somebody else has done before. So they've perfected the art of making this cake. Why would you try and reinvent the wheel? But we do every single time. Reinvent the wheel.
That's a brilliant analogy, because think of it, if you went to a restaurant and, you know, the restaurant has a cook in the afternoon, a cook in the evening, and a different cook on the weekend, and you order your food, and depending on which cook you get, it's going to be slightly different. That would drive me mad. And it certainly should drive the owner mad of the restaurant and say, no. It's like, dudes, come on. You don't do it slightly different and give it a slightly different taste and so on. But lawyers tend to be just so weirdly and fiercely independent on these kinds of things, that this is the way I do it. And so I don't know whether it's partly they don't want to be told that they've been doing it wrong because they haven't been following the process. And so to them, it's like, look, as long as I got it done at the right time, it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, if we're billing by the hour, which we continue to do, again, just will not go away, then who cares? Really? I mean, really, when you think about it, if all the risk is put onto the client, there's zero incentive for the law firms to have to follow a set process and really think about these things if they're going to get paid anyways. And even if they have to give a bit of a discount, they just don't care. It's strange. I mean, when I talk to clients now or to service providers now, and it's still difficult for them to get their heads around value billing in any form. They're already doing the calculation. How many hours is it going to take to me? Multiply by my hourly rate. And okay, that's what the fee'll be.
Yeah. We've had the most kind of, I guess, success is maybe the word I'll use, but with junior lawyers and junior professionals. So the way our business operates is very much process driven. So I've created workflows for all our core product, or I call them productized services, which really streamline the service delivery. And then to deliver the services, we have a mix of professionals. So they're not all lawyers. They come from a range of different backgrounds. To me, the process is essential for that, because you need to be able to teach these people what it is that they do and how to deliver the service. And the process really enables that to happen. But for the people we employ who are lawyers, I find that the people at the start of their career, the junior lawyers, kind of start, and they might have seen what legal practice looks like in some other firm, in big law, in traditional law, but then they come here, but they're not so ingrained in the way that things are done that they're willing to try something new. But when they do, once they've got their head around, okay, so this is a process and I follow the steps and I use these precincts and I don't reinvent the wheel and I don't have to do all this kind of grunt work, I can actually just do the fun stuff like the client engagement or the stuff that I have to think about. It's kind of like, it takes a little while, but when they get it, they're like, aha, now I see how this operates and this is better. And then it leads on to all sorts of other things. But there is like this kind of moment in time where the shift happens.
Well, again, really good point, because the younger lawyers or people who are not as familiar, they're dying for a set of rules. Right? Even, even in my students, okay, so in my course at University of Calgary, there's some of the questions they ask me just show me that they're very rules driven. Just tell me exactly what you want me to do on this in these steps. And then they're really, really happy. They're very much less comfortable what if I give them an open-ended thing to do, and then they're just, I don't know, should I do this? So get them while they're hot out of school, I guess, is the takeaway, and train them up early before they get too indoctrinated with something else. But yeah, no, very, very interesting.
Speaking of your work at the university then, you mentioned to me before we hit record that you're just gearing up to start teaching again. And I know you've spoken quite a bit about how law schools prepare law graduates for the practice of law and whether they could or should be doing things differently in that regard. What's kind of the summary of your thinking there?
Yeah, that we should blow up the law schools just the way we should blow up the law firms and start fresh.
I listened to a podcast, your interview on the Legal Ops podcast that you did earlier in the year.
Okay.
I listened to that yesterday. And one of the things you said there was that when you're teaching, you're talking about process improvement and Six Sigma and all that design thinking, all that kind of stuff. And you're telling your students, you need to know this stuff because you need to take this with you into practice. This isn't something you're just going to do in this classroom and forget about. And my question was, do you really think that's true? Because, or is that the bubble? Is that I would really like you to be doing this in legal practice when you go out there, but maybe you won't. Because my instant thought was, okay, I am in a very forward-thinking firm. I lead a lot of the development there. And even still, there's not that much talk amongst the people who I associate with about those kinds of things, unless it's kind of initiated by me.
I take the position on telling them this for the purposes of at least opening their eyes to the possibility.
Yeah.
In the hopes that they'll be at a firm like yours, or or they'll go out and create their own. So one of my stars from a class, I guess about 2 or 3 years ago, and she is one of my stars simply because she's taken everything that we talk about in class and put it in action. And I've had her back to speak to the students to try and say, look, it really works, right? And here's why, and so on. And so I think it works in a much smaller environment. I think when you get into a bigger machine, you're right. They're done. And so my hope is that if they end up in a bigger shop where all they care about is meeting their targets by the end of the month, making sure they're not furloughed and they have a job and they eventually move up through the firm, that at some point in time, they'll sit down and think about all this stuff and say, yeah, am I really happy? Could I be happier? Mm. How would I make that happier? How would I make that happen? Then I'm now in a position to maybe move in these directions. So it's really like planting a seed and hoping there'll be an oak tree 30 years from now kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're starting your own shop and more students are looking at that as an option, especially now because COVID, it sounds like a broken record, but COVID has been the pilot project for working completely differently. So the more the students can see that and say, hey, hang on a second, maybe I don't have to go in the direction that I always thought I had to go. There's some opportunities. How do I make that opportunity better? And that's where my star comes in from my class, and she's really made it work. But go back to the law school. So what I'd really like to do for a law school is start from scratch and start from the point of view of what should the tuition for this law program be. So you guys probably know that North America and UK and the law school tuition fees are like outrageous. They're outrageous. And yet the classes are full every year. And then they come out and lots of them don't have training contracts and jobs and stuff like that. Yeah. And it really is outrageous. So I'd like to start from the position of what should a legal education cost? Not what does it cost to produce? It's like, what should the cost be to the consumers? Like, should it be $5,000 a year? Should it be $1 million a year? What is that spot that really makes sense to make it? And then how do I build a program around that for that cost?
How do you answer the question about what it should cost?
Yeah. So you go to the market and say, I mean, you do your user studies, but I think the cost of legal education should be accessible to the widest range of people. And certainly in North America, it's not. I mean, we can talk about diversity all we want, but if you put a huge price tag on it, your diversity is never going to be there. So something that is accessible, something that the average person with a middle-class income, whatever we may define that as, can afford it without having huge debt, without, you know, students carrying debt for 10 years or 20 years or whatever happens to be. And so, yeah, that's a big part of it is figure out what that cost should be. But right now, no one's asking that question. Everybody's just saying, well, this is what it costs because I got to have the top professors and I got to have really big buildings and library and all this kind of stuff. And so therefore, and then we'll put a premium on it because we know we'll always get students. And so it's backwards. And I think we have to put more thought into that. And then really make every course highly practical and usable. Yeah. So in the sense that if you're teaching contracts, why wouldn't you teach like real contracts? Like, here's what a contract actually looks like. Here's a piece of paper. Because when I went to law school, and still I'm sure for many law schools, that when you take contracts, you never see the paper. You just see a lot of cases talking about concepts, which is great. But let's just get the paper out and let's make drafting part of the contract exercise and then weave in the theoretical components into it. Let's make a law school, there should be a course on running your practice, just simple finances, business development stuff, that this is how much it costs. Here's where all the money goes. Here's all the elements of your law practice. Here's how to manage your staff. What a concept, right? You know, so there's a business school kind of element to it. And it's that kind of holistic approach that needs to be taken because the law schools right now just look at one slice, which is the highly theoretical. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying, I guess you have to look at what your goal is. If your goal as a law school is just to pump out graduates and say good luck to you, then I guess the current program is totally fine. But if your goal as a law school is to train the widest range of people who will do good for society because of their diverse range of experiences in life and everything else, and give them the tools necessary so that they can hit the ground running faster than their colleagues in another city or down the street, then I think we have to really, really, as I say, blow it up and start it again. Creative disruption. Just say, you know what? Okay, let's. If we had to build a law school from zero and we didn't have all the regulations that say you must do this and you must do that, what would we really do? And then figure it out from there. And that's probably never going to happen, but that's that's my dream.
There are people who are trying. And I know some of the counter argument to that is, I've heard that it's not the university's job. That's the job of practical legal training or practice management courses that we have to do here in Australia before you can own a law practice. And I agree. I think the practice management courses that the boards require you to do before you can run your own practice, I think they're excellent. But I think it's too late. Not too late, but those skills need to be taught from day one, not just when you're about to set up a practice. You know, I want graduates to be thinking about the business of law, not just people who are 5-6 years in thinking, hey, maybe I might do my own thing now. And then all of a sudden realize, wow, I never knew how to run a trust account or how to manage my payroll or supervise staff or all of that kind of business development, all that kind of stuff.
It ties into, there's a little bit of thinking I see from time to time, people saying that, you know, universities are outliving their usefulness, that the things that are taught in university in general, not just in law school, are very expensive and less and less useful. And so the question is, are universities themselves in danger of eventually losing the market that they now have? And whether colleges that are more skills-based focus or practical focus are a way to go. Or if we look at the fact that we're becoming a lifelong learning society, does it make sense that your learning only takes place during 4 years of university? Is there some way to stretch it out over a lifetime and in a different form, whatever that may be?
Yeah. And you don't need a law degree to be deeply involved in the legal profession. You know, you talk about this in your books and we do this in our firm. There are a lot of people who are core staff in this business who don't have a practicing certificate or a law degree and they don't need one. And I think the more people if start to recognize that, the more people will say, well, I can actually do a lot of what it is that I want to do and I don't have to go to uni for 4, 5, 6 years to get there.
Yep, 100%. It's amazing when you say that, that you have people who didn't go to law school and didn't go to uni and like, but are quite happy working in a law firm because that's pretty unusual. It's not a lot of people, you know, in their life say, gosh, I really want to work for a law firm, you know, not as a lawyer, but I really want to work for that law firm. So that's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. But it's just an example of one of the points that you raise often in the work that you do, which is that the businesses need a range of professionals and that makes for a better business.
Well, even, you know, when you go through design thinking exercises, right? I just found that if you just have a group of lawyers, it's a horrible experience, yeah. Right? It's the worst. Yeah. They're hard to work with, but also the ideas are terrible, right? They're just terrible. and so the better ideas always come from people who haven't gone to law school and, you know, can think laterally and start stuck in a silo. And so, yeah, it really shows you how important it is to have different voices at the table in the law firm environment,
yeah.
Because it's so much better for everybody.
Yeah, that's it. So Mitch, the question I like to finish on with all of my guests on the podcast is for your advice. So if you were to give one piece of advice to somebody who wants to do law differently, what would it be?
I guess what I'd say is, have a really thick skin and be very, very patient. Very, very, very patient and persevere. It is a tough slog. So find your tribe, find your bubble. That'll keep you going because it might be a bit lonely for you, but certainly find your bubble, keep going. You are fighting the good fight. You are going in the right direction. And even though it may be difficult at a lot of times, just stick with it.
I love that, especially that find your bubble. I think that's so, so important, like you say, because you need to have the thick skin. But if you're in it with the people who are thinking the same way, trying to change things in the same way that you are, it's easier to push on, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. Well, I'll just give you one quick thing before we go on that is one of the reasons why I really enjoyed travel before COVID was to get a breath of fresh air from a different jurisdiction with a different group of people who are really jazzed about this kind of stuff. And it really gives me the energy when I come back home and I don't get to be part of my bubble that is like, oh yeah, those guys are doing that. That's so amazing. Now you really feel the energy. So it's really important.
Mm-hmm. And what you say there is exactly the reason why I started this podcast, because I felt exactly the same way as you whenever I would travel or go to a conference or start to meet new people who were doing things in a bit of a different way. And then I'd come back and I'd be like, oh, okay, so how can I get more of that? And that was what started this podcast. So yeah, I'm definitely thinking along the same lines. Thank you, Mitch. I've really, really enjoyed speaking to you. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. Good luck and keep going.
Thanks again for tuning in to Doing Law Differently. If you enjoyed the episode, I'd love you to leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find out about the show, and I love hearing what you think. Otherwise, if you're not on Apple Podcasts, send me a message and let me know. You can find all the past episodes at doinglawdifferently.com.au.